Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I think everybody in the audience certainly is familiar with the work of Mr. Forbes from The Great Magazine, where he is chairman of the board as well as chief editor, to all the different things. I guess that's kind of the day job. But then I think the other thing that you take on is injecting into our political debate with fiscal common sense and looking at really hard issues in terms of what we have to do to keep going and how to keep the economy strong. And then tonight, of course, he's here with the new book, Money, basically looking at how the destruction of the dollar is just adding instability to the economy as Mr. Forbes sees it. And I'll just turn it over to him. So please join me in welcoming Steve Forbes.
Thank you. Well, thank you very, very much. It's great to be here, and thank you all for coming out on a weekday evening to get some hot air. I know it's been a long winter, so maybe it'll still be welcome. But want to discuss tonight a little bit about the book. Then we'll do Q&A, and then any of you who wish to have a signed copy, be glad to do it. As long as there's not a check inside, I'll be glad to do the book itself. But the reason we did the book, I co-authored it with Elizabeth Ames, is that money, and when you say monetary policy, people become very, very inhibited. They think it's a massively confusing subject. The inhibitions and the fact that people feel that this is something that's beyond the ken of most people is one reason why, for example, the Federal Reserve has less formal oversight in Washington than do our intelligence agencies. Even though the Fed is one of the most powerful institutions in the country and in the world, when you go to congressional hearings, you can tell very quickly most of the committee members really don't understand it. They ask rote questions, many of them written by staff, and you can tell many of times the answers sail over the heads and then bob their heads as if they understand what's being said. So money, the subject of money, is shrouded in a lot of jargon, seemingly impenetrable equations. But the fact of the matter is, it's really a very simple subject. And that's why we wrote the book. And the reason we did the book is that if we don't get better understanding by our officials of what money is and what the proper policy towards it should be, we're going to lurch from one crisis to another. We had a bad one in 08 and 09. We've had many crises since then. Even if we don't have big ones, we have many small ones that can grow into big ones. We had one earlier this year with countries like Indonesia having an attack on their currency. The sad fact is that officials today know less about money, the subject of money, whether they're in policy-making positions or in economics, than their forebears did 100 years ago. Money itself is actually, as we say, very, very, very simple. But by the way, from what I'm about to do to you, let me just give you a travel tip. Because monetary policy seems something that is beyond people's comprehension and seemingly boring and, you know, something that people just wish not to discuss, if you ever find yourself in an airplane, in coach, middle seat, on the runway, watching your life pass away, and you want a little bit of elbow room with your seatmates, start talking about monetary policy, and you'll have all the elbow room you want. Or if any of you are single and on a date, or have kids are on a date, want out, tell them to talk about monetary policy, and I guarantee you, you'll never see that person again. But the subject itself is simple. Money simply makes it easier to do buying and selling with each other. Easier to do transactions. In the old days, before we had money, we had barter. And barter is very, very inefficient. For example, if 3,000 years ago, if I sold an ad in Forbes, how would I get paid? Perhaps with a herd of goats. Now, I'm being facetious here. Let's say I wanted to buy some iPads for our writers 3,000 years ago. So I go to the Apple store with my herd of goats. The store owner says, I don't want goats, I want sheep. So then I have to figure out how to swap my goats for sheep. Perhaps hire a sheep herder to make sure the wolves don't eat the sheep. The sheep herder wants to be paid in wine. I have red wine, he wants white wine. Just becomes very, 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 very inefficient. So starting about 2,600 years ago, in a place called Lydia, near the Greek states in the Mediterranean, came up with a coin. Athens quickly adopted their own coinage, became a great commercial and cultural center. But whether it's coins, piece of paper, or now blips on a computer, money makes transactions easier, makes buying and selling easier. And so in that sense, money represents value, the way clocks measure time, or a ruler measures length, or a scale measures weight. Money measures value. In and of itself, money has no value. The pieces of paper you carry around or the ellipsis on a computer have no intrinsic value. They represent a claim on products and services, just like a coat check at a restaurant is a claim. In and of itself, the coat check has no value. It's the claim that makes it useful, which gets to trust. Money communicates information, the value of something, but the only reason it works is based on trust. And so because of that, you can do transactions with utter strangers because you have a common medium because of that trust. And so we take it for granted. So in terms of money, properly done, eases transactions, makes investing easier. I mean, imagine if we had barter today, trying to deposit a cow into an ATM. Just very, very, very inefficient. Money makes it all easier. So money, in that sense, is really created by you in the marketplace, doing billions of transactions each and every day. Government does not create money. It can create the symbols of money, but real money is created by you, doing things, creating things. Just like the coat check. Creating a coat check doesn't create a coat. The coat's been created. The coat check represents what has been created. So when the government creates money out of thin air, what it's doing is it's really debasing the money in the sense that money represents things that have already been made. So when you create something out of thin air, if you do it on your own in your basement, it's called counterfeiting. If you do it at the Fed, it's called stimulus. But it's the same thing. So to work, money's got to have a fixed value, just as a ruler has a fixed length. Imagine if they floated the ruler, 12 inches and a foot one day, 8 inches the next, 16 the next. Imagine what life would be like if the Fed decided to float the clock. You have 60 minutes in an hour, 60 minutes one day, 38 the next, 86 the next. They did that, you'd soon have to have hedges, derivatives, and futures to figure out how many hours you're working. So let's say you hire somebody, do a job for 15, 20 bucks an hour. You have to figure, now is that a Colorado hour, Nevada hour, Canadian hour, Australian hour? Let's say you're baking a cake. It says bake the batter, 45 minutes. You have to figure, is that an inflation-adjusted minute? Life becomes immensely complicated. So money works best when it has a fixed value. And the problem is, when it becomes unreliable, as it has been for several decades, you pay a price for it, several prices. One is you get less investment for future things. And money then goes into not things that are unseen, like making a new product, creating a new service, building a new factory, goes into existing things. None of you are old enough to remember the 70s. It's called pandering. Tried it in politics, didn't work, which is why I'm here tonight peddling my books. But in the 70s, in the 1970s, we had the last time our central bank went off the rails in terms of money, and you had an oil boom that affected Colorado. And people really thought oil was becoming scarce, that it was going up in price. When you start trashing money, It's the equivalent of a virus in a computer. You can no longer trust the information. So you got a false energy boom. You got a false agricultural boom. And in the early 80s, when the inflation was ended, you had a depression in the energy industry, depression in agriculture. Real harm was done. Oil, for example, went from $3 a barrel to almost $40 a barrel. When the inflation was conquered in the early 80s, crashed down to 10, finally stabilized at 20 to 25. From the mid-1980s to the early part of the last decade, the average price of a barrel of oil was a little over $21 a barrel. Now, what is it today? Pick a number, 103, 110, 93, depending on where you do the drilling. How much of that is real and how much of that is because you can't trust the money? So you get misdirected investment. And then you got the housing bubble this last round. And this is not a partisan thing. This last round was started in a Republican administration, continued on steroids in a Democratic administration. So none of them get it, just to varying degrees of ignorance. Clinton got it better than most. Reagan got it better than most. Kennedy got it better than most. But many of them don't get it. President Bush didn't get it. President Obama doesn't get it. So this is not a partisan thing. This cuts across everything. So in the last part of the decade, just as we saw with oil in the 70s, this time was housing that went off crazily. Housing had a huge boom. Everyone thought housing prices must go up each year. Houses are simply a very expensive consumer product. It's not like building a factory. You pay many years to pay the thing off often. But everyone now thought housing prices could only go up. That's why they invented the new mortgage, which was, why have an income? And because since housing prices always go up, why? If the person defaults, it doesn't matter. The asset value is still going up. So you had hundreds of billions of dollars going into misdirected investment. You saw the same thing in the financial industry. There's no reason that the financial industry should be as big as it is today. It's in response to what we did in the early 70s when we destroyed the Bretton Woods international monetary system based on gold. So today, each day, in terms of currency trading, when you have unstable money, you have massive currency trading. Currency trading volume is now $3.2 trillion a day. Before the 70s, there was virtually no trading, because all the currencies are fixed to each other. They're all fixed to gold. So look at all this, not just misdirecting money, but misdirecting brain power. The best brains in the world are coming up with new exotic instruments because of the inefficiencies and misdirection created by unstable money. So it's a huge waste. It also has other repercussions we discuss in this book. It undermines social trust. John Maynard Keynes was right when he quoted Lenin after World War I. Lenin said, the best way to undermine the social order is to debauch the currency, because it undermines all of the behaviors that make society work. And Keynes observed that not one in a million will understand the process. Now, he was talking about hyperinflations, but you also can get the slow motion inflation, undermining social trust. Because what happens is you get more speculation. So people think that the link between effort and reward is eroded, and you get rich by being a crony capitalist or gaming the system, not by honest effort of coming up with new and better products or doing things better than your competitors. So you get mistrust, you get more division. We see it today, 1% versus the 99%. Taxpayers versus the 47%, young versus old. People turn in on each other when you don't have a lot of growth. In Europe, you're now seeing the rise of some pretty ugly political parties when you have this kind of stagnation and people don't understand what is happening. So the corrosiveness about money is not just economic statistics. Because it's not understood, people feel adrift. Something's not happening. Something's not right, but they can't put their fingers on it. And that is very corrosive in terms of politics. So that's why we did the book. And the mistakes continue to be made. The so-called quantitative easing, where the Fed created massive amounts of bank reserves to, quote, stimulate the economy. What it ended up doing was being a form of credit allocation. made it very easy for the federal government to borrow, very easy for large companies to borrow, very easy to put together mortgage-backed securities. But for small and new businesses, until very recently, their credit was dry. Regulators are pounding on the banks, don't lend. Well, if you're told to cut back lending, who do you lend to? The safest customers. You don't go for small and new businesses. A lot of paperwork, not worth the effort, because you don't get much return on it, and you just get in the crosshairs of regulators. So you pay a price for all of this. So that's why we wrote the book. There's no reason why we have to have another big crisis. If we understand what money is. Fixed value represents, makes it easier to do transactions. You don't create it out of thin air. It comes from what you do in the marketplace, buying and selling. So what's the best way to do it? When you mention the solution, people think, oh my God, we got somebody who's got a machine gun in the hills. When you mention a gold standard, and we say in the book, a gold standard, one of the great myths, and there are numerous myths about gold, one of the myths is that there's a single standard. No. You look at the history books, there have been numerous standards. Just like today, there are numerous democracies. Our system is very different from Canada's system, even though it's based on the consent of the governed, which is different from Britain's system, which is different from the French system, which is different from the German system. So there's more than one way to do it. But ultimately, if you understand why gold works for 4,000 years. It's not you're going to carry around gold coins. All it means is gold is a ruler. Gold has intrinsic value, which better than anything else doesn't change. When you see the price change, that's not the price of gold changing as much as it is the perception of the value of the dollar or the yen or the euro. So think of gold like Polaris, fixed. Things revolve around it. And when people feel the world is coming to an end, as we did in 1980, we did in 2008 or 2011, thing will shoot up. Then when people realize the meteor's not going to hit the earth yet, then things go down a little bit. But it has that fixed value. So how would it work? Very, very simple. So simple, you say, is that all there is to it? You fix a price. Ratio. Let's say 1,300. That's the current price. So let's pick that. All it means is 1,300 is that if it goes above 1,300, which means money's too loose, the Fed creates less money. If it goes below 1,300, it creates more money. It's like a speedometer. Just keep it at a certain level. That's all they have to do. And the rest takes care of itself. And so you don't have to have this massive intervention, massive regulation. You don't have to. In fact, if the Fed was doing its job right, you would no more know who the head of the Fed was or read about the Fed any more than you would the Bureau of Weights and Measures inside the Commerce Department, which makes sure that the inch stays an inch. I mean, they don't have much to do. It's been fixed a long time ago. But they still have the Bureau inside the Commerce Department. You could put the Fed in there and say, fix it. Keep it there, bye-bye. But we're a long ways from there because they don't know how to do it. And as I say, and we can discuss in the Q&A, we discuss in the book, there are a lot of myths about it. Oh, there's not enough gold. There's plenty. The reason gold works, it has that intrinsic value. You can't destroy it. You don't eat it. You don't drink it, unless you're crazy. And so every ounce of gold that's been mined is still in existence. They estimate about 5.5 billion ounces. You can melt it, you can smash it, you can heat it, and it doesn't. You can't destroy it. It's very compact, so it's very easy to haul around. You don't have to worry about termites eating it. You don't have to worry about leaking like oil. So over time, it's been the thing that works best. Not perfect. Anything that involves humans is not perfect, but it's the best that we have, and certainly better than what we've been doing in recent years. And there's just a look at little history. We went off the gold standard in 1971. Nixon took us off it. If we had maintained since 71 the average growth rates of this country's economic growth, remember, for 180 years, we had a gold standard till 71, except during the Civil War. If we had maintained the average growth rates, the U.S., this is 40 years, 71 to today, 43 years, our economy today would be 50% larger than it is now. Compounding over 40 years, devastating results. Imagine how much the world would be better if we had a 50% larger economy. No deficit, no problem on Social Security. A lot of things go by the boards in terms of worries. When you have stagnation, you have misdirected investment, virus in the computer, then you got trouble. So money, understand if you understand that it measures value based on trust. If you fix the value, it doesn't inhibit the size of the economy any more than having 5,280 feet in a mile restricts the number of miles of highway you might wish to build. Or 12 inches in a foot does not restrict the size of a house you might wish to build. Be based on other things, just a fixed measure of value. So hopefully when we get this thing done right, as I think we will, as people start to learn about it, then you won't have to have books like this. Be about as needing as why we have 12 inches in a foot. Might be interesting to somebody, but not something that's at the top of the news. So that's why we wrote the book, hoping to prevent future crises. Basic understanding, all the jargon around money has been way overdone. The basics are very, very simple. Making exchange transactions with each other easier. If you understand that, you're ahead of 99.9% of the economics profession. We got to get that information out there because, again, this shouldn't be political. This should be very basic, standard weights and measures, very basic. And when we get there, we'll still have problems because we're humans, but life will be a whole lot better and less uncertain and anxious about the future than what we have now. So thank you for coming out. If you have questions, I'll be glad to entertain them, and then we'll get hopefully to a book signing and books to sign. So thank you very much for your kindness. Yes?
Would you need a reserve like Fort Knox to begin this kind of transition?
The question is, would we need a reserve of gold like Fort Knox? One of the things we discuss in the book, which sounds counterintuitive, is you don't need to own, a country does not need to own a single ounce of gold to make a gold standard work. All it has to do is look at the price, which is a globally set price, and keep it within a certain range. You pick the price, I mentioned 1,300, so you have 1% on either side, because you do get a little fluctuations each day, and that's it. So whether the gold resides in Fort Knox, whether it resides at 7-Eleven, Starbucks, or some other central bank, it doesn't matter, because the gold exists. Maybe in various places, but the 5.5 billion ounces exists. So you wouldn't need it. Now, just as a backstop to make sure our friends in Washington don't misbehave, you should have a safety valve where if you feel they're misbehaving and they're not obeying the law, that you can go to the government with a bar of gold and turn it in for dollars or turn in dollars for gold just to keep them honest. But the U.S. is the only one that would have to do it. The others just look at the price and keep within a certain range. It was done sort of like that in the 19th century. During the classical gold standard, Britain set the pace. Everyone followed its example. And we had an extraordinary period in the 19th century, led by Britain and then the United States. We created more wealth than we did in all the previous centuries put together. And again, there are a lot of problems, but amazing advances. But if you hadn't had standard money, I mentioned the U.S. economy would be 50% bigger today. If we had had the same kind of growth rates since 71, from when we began, back in 1789, when George Washington took the oath of office, the U.S. economy today would be 1/4 the size that it is now. Over time, these things make a big difference, even if you don't quite notice them on a day-to-day basis. Yes?
What does it take to get back to the gold standard? Just an act of Congress? Or?
The question is what it takes to get back to a gold standard, like an act of Congress. Ultimately, it has to be an act of Congress, but we first have to get the knowledge out there. If tomorrow the government announced, oh, we'd like to go on a gold standard, it wouldn't work because they don't know what they're doing. They've got to be educated. And the importance of this, not to bore you with numbers, when Britain ran the gold standard before World War I, remember this is the 100th anniversary of the First World War, which destroyed a lot of things, Britain had 7 million ounces of gold and ran a global gold standard, even though it was only 1.5% of the global supply. After World War II, when we had a gold standard, we didn't have the knowledge the Brits had. So in the late 40s, because of the disruptions of the war, we had, for a while, 700 million ounces of gold. Today it's 261 million. We had 700 million. Because we did not know how to run the system the way the Brits did, we quickly destroyed it by 1971. So it's not the amount you have, it's knowing. So first you got to get the knowledge, then an act of Congress. And then, as Jefferson said, vigilance, so they don't misbehave. Got to have vigilance. Yeah.
In Chapter 8, I think you implied that we have to have a more mature government and political system before we go to the gold standard. Otherwise, it won't last because, Johnson does the Great Society, Nixon has to go off the gold standard. So is that correct in my interpretation of that?
Well, you have to have, for any system to work, you've got to have the knowledge. And we did not have the knowledge in the 60s. We could have kept easily, amazing thing, we could have kept easily on a gold standard, even with Johnson's Great Society, even with fighting the Vietnam War at the same time. We'd have had higher interest rates. They try to suppress interest rates to make it cheap to do all this, but they could have done it and still kept the dollar on gold, but they wouldn't have been able to do it by sleight of hand, playing games. It would have been out in the open. And then people could make choices. Is this what we really want to do? Instead of saying, oh, there's no cost, and they play games. So yeah, it's the gamesmanship. And the nice thing about a properly functioning standard is there's less room for games playing. In the late 19th century, the amazing thing is in the lead up to World War I, governments, European governments in the United States, were very, very prudent in their spending. It did not mean they didn't have social safety nets. Germany, in the mid-80s, 1880s, invented the modern welfare state, but they kept it on a gold standard. So they're very careful on spending. Britain did a lot of social legislation before World War I, but they kept it on a gold standard. Amazing, too, military expenditures as a percent of the economy was very low, even though they're doing major buildup. In fact, the gold standard saved Britain and France and the United States in World War I, because otherwise Germany would have been binging on military spending before the war, but under gold standard you couldn't do it, because you had to keep had to be prudent in your spending. So yes, it keeps honesty. Yes?
Why did people think it was a good idea to leave the standard?
Question is, why did people think it was a good idea to leave the standard? Very, very basic question. Two events undermined a very successful system that worked from the end of the Napoleonic Wars to the First World War. One was the First World War itself shattered people's faith in Western values and led to the rise of totalitarian movements, fascism, communism, Nazism. And one of the things that came out of the war was they didn't know how to put the system back together again. They had worked so well. This is what happens over time. Things work so well, we forget why it worked in the first place. So they thought after the war, war always means inflation. It just does. We had in the Civil War, we had a terrible bout after the Revolutionary War. So after the war, there was no way they could go back to the pre-war standard of their currencies to gold. They thought, oh, that means we have a gold shortage. No. You realize you had a one-time catastrophe, you should have readjusted. They should have readjusted what they call the parities and said one-time event done the devaluation, which had happened already, and been done with it. Instead, they went through inflation, they went through terrible time. So that was one thing. They'd forgotten how it started to forget how it worked, including the Brits. Then came the Great Depression. The Great Depression was seen as a repudiation of free markets. Free markets were seen as failing. As we explain in the book, what brought on the Great Depression was not some sudden failure of free markets. But what triggered the thing was a massive trade piece of legislation called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff. What we passed a major tariff. Tariffs are taxes. And in 1929, Congress started to consider a tariff bill that ended up going on a binge that put massive taxes on every import in this country. Huge taxes. Other countries said, if you're taxing our imports, we're going to tax your imports. So they destroyed the global trading system. That's what precipitated the crash in 29. Even before the legislation was signed, if the market sees something is going to go wrong, they mark down asset values before the disaster happens, if they see a disaster looming. So that's what precipitated the crash. So they didn't understand why the depression came. What the trading war that happened in 1929, 1930 was the equivalent of World War I in destroying the global trading system. The shooting this time came later. In 1914, they're simultaneous because the war started. Obviously, trade stopped, and everything was disrupted. By the way, in 1914, when the war began, you know what happened to the New York Stock Exchange? Closed for 5 months. They just couldn't imagine a world where you didn't have these trading patterns. So it was World War I, and then the Great Depression. And the Great Depression was made worse because they didn't understand why it happened. Even though they saw this trade war, they didn't connect the dots. So then they started to raise taxes. Britain raised income taxes in 30 and 31. We put in a massive tax increase as the economy was declining. We raised the top income tax rate from 25% to 63%. We put we put sales taxes, excise taxes on numerous items. We even put a stamp tax on checks. The pit of the Depression. If you wrote a check, you paid a stamp tax to Uncle Sam. It was insanity. And then they went for devaluations. They said, oh, well, we can't keep it fixed to gold. Everything's falling apart. Let's try something else. So starting with Britain, they went into devaluations. Big Brown in 31. We did it in 33. France finally did it in 36. So it was the First World War, then the Great Depression, and then John Maynard Keynes. Not to totally bore you, but this is very important stuff. Classical economists thought the real economy was creating products and services, and money was what they called the symbol economy. Classicists had it right. Keynes turned it around and said, money is the real driver of the economy, not entrepreneurs, not creating products and services. So he had contempt for business people, contempt for entrepreneurs, thought if you controlled the central bank, you control the economy. We're living with that legacy today. And he had a profoundly wrong, asked the right questions, but came to a profoundly wrong conclusion. So World War I, Depression, then it was codified in a kind of economics that's still taught in our universities today. Keynes was wrong, but we still haven't caught up with the fact he got it backwards. Classicists had it right. Long answer, but it's basic. Yes, gentleman there.
Three quick things. The $85 billion a month that the Fed is pumping in, with nothing to back it up, what do you think that's doing? Second, we've had a lot of inflation since the current administration. Gas prices doubling, groceries up, and so on, which aren't included in the CPI. And the third big question is, do you really think we still have a physical gold in the New York Depository and Fort Knox?
Answer the last question. I think the answer is yes, but let's have an audit. And if it's not there, where'd it go? Is Ben Bernanke hiding in his attic or something? And the key thing is it still exists. That's the key thing to keep in mind. But that's why you should always have an audit every 6 months, every 12 months. You do with anything else. If you have an account with a money manager, Ken Fisher, who writes for us, who's also a money manager, independent money manager, says you should always make sure the custodianship of your securities is not with the money manager. Should be separate, so you don't get Bernie Madoff kinds of things. So you should have an audit, an independent audit. In terms of the $85 billion a month, it's now down to $45 billion, what they call quantitative easing. I love the phrases they come up with for this stuff. Creating money out of thin air. They're tapering that. They're calling it the taper, which is a good thing. What it's doing is stopping the Fed from sucking, in effect, money, puts it in, then sucks it out from the banking system to finance the federal government. They're tapering that, which is why you're starting to see bank lending go up. We'll see if it lasts, but bank lending's starting to grow again, which gives me hope for a later part of the year for the economy. What they call quantitative easing effectively did was the equivalent of what doctors used to do a couple of hundred years ago. When you got sick, they'd bleed you. And George Washington died being bled to death because he was ill, I think, with pneumonia or something. So they bled him to cure the pneumonia, of course, killed him. Did it all the time. So the Fed's been engaging in the equivalent of bleeding, and the less bleeding they do, the better our economy will be. So that part's critical. And the third thing you asked about?
The inflation.
Yes. This gets to something very interesting. Inflation. How do you define inflation? That most economists will say, well, take the consumer price index. What they don't tell you is they keep changing the consumer price index all the time. And so what they measure as rising prices is not what the real world's experiencing. You go to and just one example, when Steve Jobs invented the iPhone, which retailed for $499, how in the world did the gnomes who run the CPI factor that in? It was much more expensive than typical handhelds, but it had great design. How do you factor that in? Great features. How do they factor that in? The answer is they don't really know how. So the CPI number is, treat it with a Missouri attitude, you know, show me. It's not to be taken too seriously. So the cost of living's going up more than the numbers reflect, and you see it in the every time you go to the supermarket. The thing to keep in mind is don't focus too much on that as much as look at the damage they've already done. Look what the housing bubble did. Look what the massive crushing of small and new businesses has done to our recovery. So the symptoms when they misbehave may change. In the 70s, we had a rip in the consumer price index. There's no disguising it, no matter how they wanted to change it. This time we haven't had that rip on that scale, but we had other disasters. So the symptoms may change, but the illness is the same, absolutely. And I won't bore you with what they call chained CPI. Well, I will, and then we'll get to the signing. To deal with Social Security, which is dealable if you have a growing economy, we can fix it pretty easily. But so they want to change the CPI so you don't have to have as big an increase in the cost of living adjustments they make in Social Security payments each year. So one of the things they want to do is the chained CPI. What that means is they want to take out, in effect, items like food and fuel or changes in people's consumption patterns. So let's say the price of chicken and steak go up to $100 a pound and everyone's eating dog food. What chained CPI would say is since no one's eating chicken or steak anymore and now eating dog food, prices haven't gone up because they're spending the same amount but they're buying dog food instead of steak. So there's no need to increase the CPI. That passes for great economic thinking. Yes?
I think we can anticipate your answer, but can you see any positives in the growth of cyber currencies like Bitcoin?
The growth of Bitcoin is a cry from young technology people for a new currency, for an alternative currency. And if you see it that way, then you can overcome its shortcomings as money. First, it fluctuates. Money should not fluctuate. They say they're only going to have a fixed number created, or they call mined, 21.5 million or something. That's not money. If you have a vibrant economy, you should be able to create as much money as the economy needs because it's being created by you making products and services. It's real. So this arbitrary limit on it is not money. They fall into the monetarist trap. So, but it's an interesting phenomenon, and what it speaks to is that people are now searching for alternatives. Right now, the government makes it very difficult to come up with an alternative currency. You risk going to jail if you try to create an alternative currency. We recount briefly in the book a guy who created Liberty Dollars. Did not look like dollars at all, but they're backed 100% by gold and silver. The FBI arrested him, called him a financial terrorist, and he got sentenced to jail, even though it was voluntary, people using this alternative. So you gotta, one of the things we suggest is you got to break that kind of monopoly. So again, it's a backstop. Government does it right, no one's going to want to create an alternative currency. But that's what the cyber thing with Bitcoin is. We'll do one more question, and I know some of you got to get to.
How safe is the dollar remaining in the international reserve currency?
Question is, how safe is the dollar in terms of remaining the international reserve currency? Right now, it'll remain because there's no alternative. And that's why people are so frustrated. There's no alternative. It's not the Chinese yuan. China has no real capital markets like ours. Japan, same thing. The euro, yes, it has more people using the euro than formerly using the dollar. But the problem is they don't have the capital markets we have. Germany's capital markets are a fraction of ours. So the vibrancy and the creativity of our capital markets are huge. In Europe, one of their problems is, then we'll get to the book signing, one of the problems in Europe is they have really backwards capital markets. All depends on big banks. Banks are important, but in this country we have stocks, mutual funds, hedge funds, equity funds, venture capital funds, whole array of things that enable us to be entrepreneurial. If something gets blocked on one source, we create a new one. Europe doesn't have that. In Europe, you get to a certain size, you're forced to merge with another company. They don't have the capital markets to nurture new businesses. And one of the key things in closing that people have pointed out makes this country different from others. Just ask the question, for all the dumb things we've done, we still over time grow faster than other developed economies. Why is it, even though we have the largest economy in the world, we grow faster than other developed economies like Germany or France or Italy, even though they're smaller, so it should be a little easier to grow more proportionately? Because we create, among other things, new big companies. I mentioned the terrible 1970s. But look what's starting to emerge in the 70s, even during a terrible decade. FedEx was invented, Southwest Airlines, Apple, Amgen, Oracle, Microsoft, which became today's great companies. Look how Google came out overnight. A couple of kids in the late 90s beat Microsoft and others, a search engine. Create a company now that's gobbling up the world, supposedly. So the ability, but Germany doesn't do it, France doesn't do it. Britain's a little better than the continent, which is why a lot of French people moved to Britain or to the United States. And that's why when a candidate ran for president of France, he made note that the sixth largest French-speaking city in the world is London. Why? Because if you want to do anything, can't do it in France. You go to London or you go to the United States to develop. So the vibrancy of our capital market, we're doing our best to destroy that vibrancy, but that's why, again, we got to get the sound money so we can get back to doing real things. Well, again, thank you for your patience and kindness, and we'll do the signing. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.